Good morning, everyone. If you'll take your Bibles and please turn to Ezekiel chapter 37. Continue our thought about the Valley of Dry Bones, and we're going to apply that to marriage today. Well, you remember we talked about 3 weeks ago the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel chapter 37. We talked about how God can revive our personal spiritual life. Children of Israel are in captivity. All hope seemed to be lost. And the question was asked, Son of man, can these bones live? Ezekiel said, O Lord, you know. Only God knows in this far out situation. In verse 4 again, he said to me, prophesy over these bones. And I said to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you that you may come to life. And the children of Israel, by the power and providence of God, came out of Babylonian captivity. A remnant was restored. Jesus Christ came into the world, and we are members of the Lord's church today. God has the power, we have the faith. And of course, we talked about that, and God can revive our spiritual life when we feel down or dead. But there's another aspect of this about, can these bones live? There's a lot of trouble or problems in marriage. Reviving a dying marriage. This is a picture by Tassad of Michael, who was King David's wife. Interesting account in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 16. Then it happened as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David that Michael, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. And this is mentioned again in 1 Chronicles 15, verse 16. She was literally a princess. She was the daughter of Saul. She grew up in the king's household. She was a city girl. She was used to the refinement of the king's court. And David was a country boy. And she thought he was acting uncouth and doing something that was unbefitting a king. And it says in 6:23, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children till the day of her death. One commentator said Michal's childlessness was the result of estrangement from David. Now, some commentators will say she was cursed, but very well may have been they never resolved this conflict, that she despised him. And so their marriage apparently died, didn't do very well. And we have challenges today. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them, the New American Standard says. The USA, divorce rate. Now, we like to lead the world in gold medals. Well, sadly, we lead the world in the divorce rate. In the year 1900, the divorce rate in the United States was 7%. It was 14% in 1950. It's 47% in 1975. 51% in 1993, and the year 2008, 46% of all marriages involved a remarriage for one or both spouses. So when you look at those statistics, that's roughly half. We need to take into account that some of those are remarriages, okay? So that some in 1993, they are getting remarried from before. So it's not as bad, but it's still pretty bad. Well, you remember Jesus said in Matthew 19, verse 6, what God has joined together, let not man separate. God brings us together. God can keep us together. But we, by making wrong choices, can cause God's plan for marriage to fail. The first marriage divorce rate is about 41%. Sometimes people think, well, you get a little experience, you just try it again, you'll do better. That's a very common easy-come, easy-go attitude in our society. If it doesn't work out, we'll just divorce and try again. The second marriage, the divorce rate is 60%. The divorce rate for the third marriage is 73%. Because it indicates that a person has not learned the skills or maturity of how do you make a marriage work. Pew Research 2011, the percentage of Americans who are married is shrinking. A lot of that is those who are cohabiting or living together in fornication or sin, the Bible calls it, is going up. The percentage is now the lowest it's been in at least 50 years. Now, this is really sad. Now, it's going to get good in just a moment, but this is a sad statistic. 68% of couples surveyed feel stuck in an unhappy relationship and have made no New Year's resolution to improve it. So, can we revive a dying marriage? What's interesting, Linda Waite, who is a sociologist at the University of Chicago, and she wrote a book called The Case for Marriage, which is a summation of her research. She surveyed 5,000 married couples. She said the unhappy couples in the study who decide to divorce, like, I'm not happy, I'm going to divorce, get out of this unhappy marriage, are no happier than those who stayed married. Then Waite's research team also reported that 2/3 of the unhappily married spouses who stayed married reported that their marriages were happier 5 years later. So that indicates to me a desire to work on the marriage or improve the marriage. And what's interesting, this particular book, they report a statistic in this book, The DNA of Relationships, that Gary Smalley, who's done a lot, he's written 40 books on about marriage, said that the clinic that he helps to oversee, both his sons are clinical psychologists, and they counsel from a biblical perspective, a worldview, that in this marriage intensive, 93% of dead marriages, that is terminal marriages, we are getting a divorce. And he said they would come together, they wouldn't hold hands, they wouldn't speak to each other. But 93% of these dead marriages were revived by using biblical principles. Well, because love is a choice. And what they did is they identified core fears in the marriage. That is, when you have conflict, how does that make you feel? Well, that identifies a core fear that you have. If you don't identify and resolve that, then you can't have a successful marriage, they found. Taking personal responsibility. You can't change your spouse, you can only change yourself. But you can't influence your spouse. And then that's how you lovingly influence them. And what's interesting, as I read through this book, I thought these principles that they uncovered, and they were doing counseling from a biblical perspective, is reflected in the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon is the longest treatment of marriage, and it emphasizes romantic marriage, but also emphasizes the principle of how to have a happy or successful marriage. So, love is a choice, and a dying marriage can be revived with God's help, because love never fails, as Mark read for us. So, can these bones live? Marital conflict resolution in the book of Song of Solomon can help revive a dying marriage. I like that picture. They look so happy in that picture. King Solomon, his Shulamite bride, means she was from the village of Shunem. So, and then this book, we'll look at chapter 5. You'll turn over to Song of Solomon, chapter 5. Three basic points. You understand marital conflict and fears. That's from chapter 5 to 6. And then there's taking personal responsibility to lovingly resolve the conflict. We see that reflected in chapters 5 and 6. And then in chapter 7 and following, you see them taking practical steps of how do you strengthen the marriage. Don't neglect it. Build it up. Make it stronger. So, understanding marital conflict and fears. Let's look at chapter 5, verses 2 through 6. Chapter 4 is their honeymoon. And they are so in love. But chapter 5, verse 2, is the honeymoon over? She says, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. So, either she's having a bad dream or she's having a very restless night. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. He uses four names to describe her. She's a fellow Jew or a sister, a spiritual sister. My darling, my dove, my perfect one. Four names he piles on together. What's the purpose of your middle name? Is to know when you're in trouble. William Frank Walton, come here. Now, so he's in trouble. He says, my head is drenched with the dew, my locks with the damp of the night. He's out late at night. And he comes to the door. She's in bed, and he wants to come in. Verse 3, she says, "I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again?" So she rebuffs him. Either he was late, he was supposed to come, or he didn't tell her where he went to. Or maybe she's afraid that he is out seeing somebody else. So she is mad. She is upset. "My beloved extended his hand through the opening." That's the opening of the door. "My feelings were aroused for him." So she started thinking, well, he's not such a terrible jerk after all. And so she was going to let him in. "And I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh," that is, she was prettying herself up for him, "on the handles of the bolt. And I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and had gone." So he felt rejected. He felt rebuffed. He went into his man cave, wherever that is. "My heart went out to him as he spoke, and I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer me." So Solomon is late, or he's coming in late at night, and she is upset. One of the interesting things that we need to understand, that in marriage, we need to identify destructive habits to romantic love. That's been identified in a book called Love Busters. Such things as selfish demands. "I want what I want, and I don't care how that affects you." Disrespectful judgments. I disrespect what you think. I devalue you. Angry outbursts, losing our temper, yelling and screaming. Annoying habits. You know, she can't keep house, or he's, has the personal hygiene of a pig, whatever you may be thinking. Independent behavior, do something without talking to the other one, how it impacts them. Dishonesty, can't be trusted. Keeping secrets from one another. Well, these habits that we may do, maybe Solomon was being thoughtless, whatever, that it caused a negative reaction in her. So the underlying issue a lot of times is bigger than what time it is in opening a door. Now, what's the big deal? He comes in late at night, it's dark outside. And just, would you open the door? Okay, so what's the big deal about that? Why is that such a big issue? That's not the issue. It represents something. What does this represent, you staying out late at night, and I've already gone to bed? Either you were forgetful, something else is more important than me, or maybe you're seeing somebody else. So it pushes a hot button, a fear. And she just says, I've already gone to bed. Well, poor little thing, some words hurt your feelings and you run away. Well, it's not just those words. Those words touch a sensitive area. It touches a fear. So the underlying issue is bigger than what time it is in opening the door. So marital conflict exposes emotional fears beneath the surface. Chapter 5, verse 7, "The watchman who makes the rounds in the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick." I am upset. Now, either she's having a dream that she's looking for him and can't find him, and she's beating herself up because they've had this conflict, or this actually did happen because they mistook her for a prowler. But the idea is that she says, "I am lovesick, I am upset." And what we need to do, understand, is that a lot of times there are underlying causes of conflict. If we have reoccurring conflict, and a lot of times we can't figure out why do we have this reoccurring conflict, we need to remember what it says in chapter 2 and verse 15. This is a great verse about marriage. In chapter 2, verse 15, "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom." What does it mean to catch the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards? The little foxes would burrow down beneath the surface. They would make a burrow. And in that burrowing, they would damage the roots. And they might gnaw on the tender roots. And then from the, you could see that the vineyard looks healthy, but at the roots, underneath the surface, there's something that has been damaged. And that's what happens in marriage. External conflict is rarely the real problem, but it's symptomatic of an underlying relational problem. There's more to it than just this particular incident. This incident, whatever it may be, is simply the match that lit the fuse of the problem that we already had. Look at chapter 6 and verse 5. What does Solomon say as they are trying to make reconciliation? He says, "Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me." The New American Standard, I think, is a good translation here. King James will say that you have overwhelmed me. But the idea of the Hebrew word is being taken by a storm upsetting things. He says that he's upset, and I don't understand exactly what's going on. Conflicts in marriage take place when a marital need is not met. So catch the little foxes. And the idea is that how do you keep the vineyard healthy? Keeping out the little foxes, but then you also have to nourish the vineyard. And you think about what's generally needed by men: physical affection, respect and admiration, an attractive spouse, domestic support, friendship, that is recreational companionship. And your assignment is a husband and wife read through the book of Song of Solomon together. Notice these things about how they interact. It's a difficult book, but it's got a lot of good practical advice in it. What are her needs? Affectionate affirmation from her leader, communication, honesty and openness, financial support or security, and family commitment. And they're somewhat similar, but they're also different. So the idea of becoming one flesh is we understand the needs of the other, and they may be different. And it's being able to see things from their perspective and their needs. So they had, Solomon and the Shulamite had different needs. And so when they have this conflict, how does this conflict make you feel? And when you can identify how this conflict makes me feel, you have identified a core fear underneath this conflict in marriage that causes a marriage to go dead. Now, we're in charge of our hot buttons, but we do have hot buttons, these core fears that underlie conflict when our needs are not met. Like, do you feel devalued, invalidated, or disrespected? That whatever I think, feel, or need, the other just sort of ignores it, doesn't pay attention to it. I express an opinion that's just slapped down, that's invalidated. I feel disrespected, my feelings. What about you feel deprived, insecure, or rejected? She felt maybe insecure. Where have you been? If you cared enough about me, you wouldn't be out late at night. He felt rejected, and that's why he left. Men hate to feel controlled, powerless, defective. If a wife complains about money, then it's like, well, are you saying I'm a failure? Are you saying I'm defective, that I can't make you happy? Make a man feel inept, inadequate by constant criticism or nagging. What about insecure, disconnected, alone, ignored? Women fear that. They want security in a relationship. So you have to understand when you have conflict, you don't look at the issue, but this issue is an occasion that pushes a hot button, and that's a core fear. And if you don't identify those core fears in your relationship, you're always going to have problems. So we have to understand that. So they had a core fear that was, I think, provoked. And what's interesting here, let me go back. The interesting thing about fears, what is one of the most common commands in the Bible? Fear not. God says, fear not, I'm with you. Jesus says, fear not, it is I. As human beings and with feelings, we all have fears about the negative outcome of some kind of situation. So the Shulamite bride, notice the next point here is the Shulamite bride takes responsibility to resolve the conflict. We need to act better than we feel. What does she do? She chooses to focus on Solomon's good traits. Instead of thinking about what's bad, she thinks about what's good. In marriage counseling, if you talk to someone, you say, what are the three best traits in your spouse that attracted you to them? And if And then they'll tell you that, and they'll say, what are the three things that bother you the most? And if they can tell you the three things that bother you the most, real quick, and it's hard to think of the other three, that tells you what you're thinking about. She chooses to focus on the good traits. What kind of beloved is your beloved, O most beautiful among women? What kind of beloved is your beloved that you thus adjure us? And this is the chorus, which is this is a love story or poem in Song of Solomon. And so she says, my beloved is dazzling. That means bright. So when he describes, she's not just describing his physical appearance. I think it's more than that. She describes his physical appearance, but also how he appears to her. I remember this old farmer where I used to preach in college, and he said, you know, when I married my wife, she wasn't very pretty. But over time, she got prettier and prettier. He just thought that was real interesting. Well, what we think of one another affects how we see one another. She says he's dazzling, bright. He's ruddy. He's outstanding among 10,000. He's the best for me. It's not that I just settled. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water bathed in milk, reposed in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. So apparently he doesn't have bad breath or morning breath. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold, his set with beryl. His abdomen is carved ivory inlaid with sapphire. So she's thinking of something more than that's literal, that he just has this really fine appearance because she sees him as a fine person. His legs are pillars of alabaster or marble set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon. That was the king of the trees, the cedars of Lebanon. Choice as the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He says that he is wholly desirable. So physically, emotionally, spiritually, his character, she says he's completely desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend. So she wants a best friend. In marriages, we should become best friends. And that's looking at the best in one another. When you have a friend, you may disagree, but you don't want to get rid of your friend. She focuses on the good traits. In verse 3 of chapter 6, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. I'm committed to him and he is committed to me. So we are responsible to control our thoughts from whence our feelings arise. If we think we are a victim, I cannot help the way that I feel, we can't be happy in marriage. And that's a great freedom. Between stimulus and response, there's a space, and in that space lies our freedom to choose and our destiny. Viktor Frankl said, the last of all freedoms is the freedom to choose one's attitude in any given circumstance. And he said that from his experience in a Nazi concentration camp. So she is choosing her thoughts to help her marriage and help her relationship. So our thoughts, our feelings come from our thoughts. And Solomon chooses to reconcile the relationship despite feeling confused in verse 5. What does he do? Chapter 6, verse 2. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flock in the garden. Solomon had flocks, Ecclesiastes tells us, and to gather lilies. I like that phrase. He went to gather lilies. One time I was in a store and I bought some flowers for Debbie. And as I was going through the checkout line, and it was interesting, there was a guy behind me. He had flowers too. And the okay, well, while you fix that, I'll continue this story. I'll drag this out as long as I can. So why did that happen?
I do not know.
I do not know. Okay. Well, we all can choose our thoughts, can we not? All right. So I was standing in the line, and she asked me, what occasion is this? And I said, well, I want to stay out of trouble, okay? And then she asked the guy behind me, he said, now what's the occasion for you? He says, oh, I am in trouble. Solomon gathers the lilies. Okay, you're doing good, Wally. Now, let's go on down to slide 18. Whoops, no, it's not. It's slide 18 on mine, but yours is different because of the song. So we are on reconciliation Forgiveness and love are learned from God. Let's go. Keep going. Let's go. Keep going. Next one. That's it. One before. Right there. Got it. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Okay, next one. We cannot change our spouse. That's one thing. If my spouse would change, you can't change your spouse. But we can only change ourselves. Which is the process by which we can positively influence them. That's what the Bible says in 1 Peter 3. Those women who have a husband who is not a believer, that they can be won without a word when they observe your chaste and godly behavior. So in marriage, if we sit around and wait for, well, when my spouse, when they straighten up, when they change, if it's, I tell you what, if the problem is 10% me, I need to work on that and use that to influence them. And in that book, The DNA of Relationships, he recounts a woman that had a very selfish husband, and she gave up trying to change him, and she said, I asked God, help me to change myself. And she learned to find her happiness and fulfillment ultimately in God, and ultimately she influenced her husband to change. But reconciliation, forgiveness, and love are learned from God, in whom we must find ultimate fulfillment. Now I skip. There we go. Look at chapter 6. He is going to reconcile here in verse 4. Notice what he says to her. Now Solomon chooses to reconcile. He says, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, city in the north, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. That is, you're breathtaking. He goes on to say to her, verse 5, your hair is like a flock of goats that had descended from Gilead. Now, in the context there, she's a shepherdess, and he's using some powerful imagery that she just loves. You take a look at the distance and a mountainside. Off of the distance, you have this large herd of goats, this undulating stream of goats that she loves as a shepherdess. And she's going to be thinking, that's pretty good. I know that's hard to believe. In verse 6, your teeth are like flocks of ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins. It's like you've got nice, pretty white teeth, and you've got all your teeth. What a woman! Not one among them has lost her young. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. So he's looking, even to her teeth, he's saying, you look good. Appreciate the small things. And it builds appreciation for the whole person. And then verse 10, who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army of banners? The idea of this win-win situation. And conflict resolution is not I'm going to win and you lose. You're going to both try to win. What is a resolution that is suitable to both? She says, I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine is budded or the pomegranates have bloom. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. In other words, she's reattached to Solomon. She's up in the chariot with him. They have reconciled. So it is a win-win situation. And we need to remember that all of this is learned from God. In chapter 8 and verse 6, chapter 8, verse 6, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. That is all-consuming, irreversible, irresistible, totally committed. Jealousy or desire is as severe as Sheol. That is, once it has you, it won't let go. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Where do we learn this invincible love to work through problems, to grow stronger, and to revive a dead marriage? We learn it from God. So how we feel in our marriage is a reflection of our relationship with God. Because I have to depend upon God to meet my ultimate needs. If we demand an imperfect person to perfectly satisfy myself, I'm setting myself up for disappointment. Now, the Bible talks about meeting one another's needs. In 1 Corinthians 7, render due benevolence. We have a responsibility to one another. But we cannot expect perfection or we will be disappointed. Hopefully it's a process of progress, but we depend ultimately on God to satisfy us. Psalm 73:25, Whom do I have in heaven but you? And having you, I desire nothing else on the earth. You notice what they do in strengthening their marriage in chapter 7. They communicate to create a safe, welcoming environment for understanding and appreciation. In chapter 7 and verse 1, he says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter." He notices her feet. And notice in verse 4, "Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon, that is, they had abundant water by the gate of Bathrabi. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, which faces Damascus." Now, however that looked, I imagine it had to look pretty good. "Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon." You know, he could learn to like a big nose, okay? "Your head crowns you like Carmel." And he goes on to say, verse 6, "How delightful and how beautiful you are, my love, with all your charms." And what does she say about him in verse 10? "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." So we always try to compliment more than we criticize. Don't take the good points for granted, to praise and build up. And then notice in chapter 7, verse 11 through 13, they take initiative to satisfy each other's needs. Instead of waiting, "Well, when you do this, then I'll be happy." They take initiative to try to satisfy each other's needs. Chapter 7, verse 11, "Come, my beloved, and let us go out into the country, and let us spend the night in the villages." Now, this is the Shulamite talking to Solomon. Chapter 2, Solomon is the one that initiates, "Let's go out into the countryside. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards, and let us see whether the vine is budded and its blossoms have opened, whether the pomegranates have bloomed, and there I will give you my love." So think about what can we do so we're not in a boring, predictable rut. Take initiative. What can I do that will meet their needs, that will make them happy? And when you're both working together, that makes for a wonderful marriage. And then notice, she cultivates positive thoughts about him. She says, "Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed in my mother's breast, and I found you. If I found you outdoors, I would kiss you, and no one would despise me." In other words, she's thinking, "I wish I could show a public display of affection, but as your wife, it would be inappropriate. But if we were brother and sister, if we could show some brother and sister affection, no one would think anything." So she's thinking fond thoughts. She's going to restrain herself. She says, "I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother who used to instruct me, and I would give you spiced wine to drink from the fruit of my juice of my pomegranates. Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases." Cultivate positive thoughts about our spouse during the day. What precedes physical divorce is emotional divorce. This is a slow rot of why do you think soap operas and things like that are so popular? You have people that are visualizing, "I'm not happy in my current relationship," and you kind of vicariously live through these other sordid type of storylines. So cultivate positive thoughts about one another during the day. And then notice they grow in this committed love that's only learned from God. Verse 7, "Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised." And we had a plaque someone gave us for 1 Corinthians chapter 13 about love is patient, love is kind, love does not act unbecomingly, love does not keep a record of wrongs, love is not rude, love bears all things, believes all things, endures all things, love never fails. And if you just read through that and say, "Are we doing that to each other?" that will revive any kind of weak elements in our marriage. So marriage is life's most intense relationship. Yes, these bones can live, because only God's wisdom can revive and revitalize love and make it flourish. And if you need the prayers of the saints in your relationship, if you have any struggles, we're, as a family, we're a hospital for sinners in recovery. And we invite you to come. If you have a spiritual need, we'll pray with you and for you. Won't you come while we stand and sing?